Josh here with a short announcement. As I say in the outro of every episode, I am part of a podcast network called Parthenon. This includes James Early, who hosts Key Ballads of American History, Scott Rank, who does History Unplugged, Richard Lim, who does This American President, and Mark Vinette, who does Historical Jesus and the History of North America. It also has the show History of the Papacy, hosted by Steve Guerra. What I want to do is I want to present to you a clip from his podcast. Hope you enjoy. Thank you.
Welcome to the History of the Papacy podcast, a podcast about the history of the popes of Rome and Christian Church. Prepare yourself to step behind the ropes and leave the official tour of the story of the popes and Christianity. I'm your host, Steve Guerra, and I thank you for joining me on this journey. Welcome back to another episode in a series of episodes from the History of the Papacy podcast. Today, we are joined by Gary Stevens, host of the History in the Bible podcast, to talk about the Septuagint translation of the Bible. Gary, how are you doing down under today?
I'm doing just fine on this sort of muggy, wet summer day.
And we are not recording on the usual Saturday night. It's Monday night. It feels a little weird, or Monday night's Tuesday morning.
I suppose it might feel weird to you, Steve, but I'm retired. And to us old people, all days are the same.
Do you sometimes lose track of the day?
Yeah, I do, actually. I did yesterday. I had no idea what day it was.
And with that marking of time, January of 2023 marks the 10th year anniversary of the History of the Papacy. We're getting a round of applause from Gary. Much has changed over the last 10 years, as people might suspect. But as the History of the Papacy, I produced hundreds of episodes, hours upon hours of content, and I've had my ups and my downs. We all have over the last 10 years, but it's definitely been an incredible journey for me, and I thank all of you dearly for joining me on this trip through the history of the popes of Rome and Christian Church. And I really have enjoyed every bit of the last 10 years, especially all the great people I've met through creating this podcast. I can't even begin to name all of the people who I've collaborated with, become friends with, and had wonderful conversations with. But there is no other podcast who has had a bigger impact on the History of the Papacy podcast than Gary Stevens. So I thought it would be perfect to have him join me as a co-host for this 10th year spectacular. Thank you so much, Gary.
It is a pleasure. And dear listener, what you do not know is that Steve is the one who really kicked off my podcasting career. I remember I was in a Facebook group called History Podcasters, I suppose, and I was asking the group all sorts of questions. And Steve, who I had no idea who he was at the time, said, "Well, have you got a script? I wouldn't mind seeing it." I thought, "Yeah, I've just written a script, my very first script." Sent it off to Steve. He liked it. And so that was the encouragement I needed to actually start recording the whole show. So I owe Steve a debt of gratitude and thank you.
No, it's my pleasure. I love when new podcasts start, because then it drags more people into the pit of recording and trying to figure out microphones.
Yeah.
Descent into technical nightmares. But it's all going to work out well today. And I just like to just a few short comments, reflections on 10 years of podcasting before we begin. And I mean, just with Gary, I tried to figure out the time that what percentage of the podcast you've been on, and I really couldn't, because it would require a lot more work than it was probably worth, but it's a lot of time that we've been on the microphone together.
Yeah.
And then I have to heap praises on my wife and kids for putting up for the life of a podcasting family, the hours of being quiet so I can record, putting up with hours of me editing episodes, the piles of books around the house, towering piles of books. So I can't express how much annoyance that they've been put up with. And then really the whole project has taught me so much. I realized very early in this podcast would not be a straight through retelling of the biographies of the bishops of Rome. And to me, the history of the papacy is much more than a simple biography. It's politics, theology, the birth of and death of empires, and the history of peoples that goes back long before the birth of Christ and the beginning of the Christian church. I have received criticisms for this approach, and I can understand that people want and may expect certain things from a podcast. What I have always enjoyed about the genre of podcasting, especially history podcasts, is that it doesn't have to be done a certain way. It is still a genre where people can experiment and try new things. With that, I have a really fun series in mind, at least fun for me, and I hope for you too. Indulge Gary and I as we talk about one of the topics that over the past decade has become one of my favorites, and I think a fan favorite as well, the Bible. The Bible is the foundational document of Christianity and Judaism. You don't really have a Christianity or a Judaism if you don't have the Bible. The Bible, of course, is made up of two really different parts from the Christian perspective, the Old Testament and the New Testament. Judaism obviously doesn't include the second part. Two of the main books that I used was When God Spoke Greek by Timothy Michael Law, and then Septuagint as Christian Scripture by Martin Hengel, plus many articles and websites. So reach out if you would like to learn more, and I can send you some more information on that.
That Septuagint is Christian Scripture. That sounds really intriguing. Okay, Steve. So our topic of the day in this special 10th anniversary edition is the Septuagint. Now, the Septuagint, which I suppose most people have never even heard of, is a particular translation of the Hebrew text into Greek. Now, well, first, where does the name Septuagint come from?
So the Old Testament or Hebrew Bible, we'll put a pin in what we're going to call this Hebrew Bible for the moment. We'll get into that in a bit more detail. It's really the topic of the day for this program, namely that translation you mentioned, the Septuagint. The Septuagint is really an extremely important document for the history of the Second Temple Judaism, of which the sects of Christianity and modern Judaism spring out of. And so I really wanted to learn about and evaluate the impact of this translation, this incredible translation on history. And the Septuagint shows there was a wide diversity of thought and text running through Second Temple Judaism. There was also a wide variety of just ideas floating around in this stew of Second Temple Judaism. And I like this quote from the Septuagint as Christian Scripture by Emeritus Professor of New Testament and Ancient Judaism at the University of Tübingen in Germany, Martin Hengel. The Septuagint, although itself consisting of a collection of Jewish documents, wishes to be a Christian book.
Now, Steve, that is a very intriguing statement. As we'll soon find out, the Septuagint was mainly compiled well before Jesus Christ was born. So what does it mean to say that this thing, which was a Jewish book written pre-Christian, wishes to be a Christian book? I don't get it.
I think that it's saying that there was a thought stream that really fed into the Christian movement, that Christianity just didn't pop out of nowhere in the first century AD, common era, that there was these precursors that were reaching back into really deeply into Second Temple Judaism that maybe came to full fruition in the first century of the common era, because we see people like Philo of Alexandria, which I did a short episode on. This guy's as Jewish as they get. I think he died right around the time he would have died maybe around in the late 20s-ish, 30s AD, but he may have never even heard of Jesus. But so much of his writing has Christian elements to it, to the point where people almost say like he was Christian himself, but he had really no connection whatsoever to the Christian movement, except that he was in this milieu going on of late Second Temple Judaism.
Okay, so Philo shows that some of the themes, concepts of Christianity were swirling around in Jewish thought in general before Christianity coalesced some of them. Is that right?
Yeah, and especially some of these strains, the apocalyptic strain, that really didn't get picked up in rabbinical Judaism, are the main themes of Christian religion and that version of Second Temple Judaism. And we'll touch upon some of those issues as we go along, because you can see where some of these ideas, like the apocryphal books that get translated into the Septuagint, don't make it into the, I guess, the Ur-Proto-Masoretic text, but let's not get, we'll definitely, those will become major issues down the line. But so a couple of questions that I had going into this, and I think that they're really the guiding questions for the whole series, is why translate Jewish scriptures into Greek? Like, where did that come from? Why did the Septuagint have such an impact on early Christianity? Why did the Septuagint translation become such a wedge issue between early Christians and the early rabbinical Jewish movement? And then why did the Septuagint fade out from Western Christian usage, at least at the top level, fairly early on? But why did the Septuagint hang on so long in Eastern Christian usage? And whether we can answer any of these questions or not, probably not, because we're not scholars, but I think that we'll be able to at least point you in some of the right directions, or get you thinking out there about some of these questions and digging a little deeper.
Okay. Now, the Christian Bible is divided into two sections, the New Testament and the Old Testament. These are pretty different, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, so the New Testament is a pretty tight and well-organized anthology. The New Testament's a group of documents written by a relatively small group of authors within a really specific time frame and geography. The authors are diverse in many ways, but not completely really out of left field from each other. It has the Gospels and the Book of Acts, which are really histories. Then it has the teaching and the pastoral letters. And for the most part, the New Testament was written entirely in the Hellenistic, koine is how some people say it. I think you might pronounce it kine.
Is it koine?
Koine. I've heard it pronounced a couple of different ways, so yeah. I'm sure all of those are wrong on how I've said them. But I mean, is there anything you would disagree with fairly much the New Testament is a tight document? Yeah. In a well-organized document, I would say.
Yeah, it is a pretty compact little thing when you think about it. The point hadn't actually occurred to me. But yet, compared to the Old Testament, it's, as you say, it's delimited very sharply in time. Maybe about 150 years in total, from earliest book to latest book, maybe even a lot shorter. And it's very tightly organized thematically. I mean, the same sort of themes come through in almost every book.
And they're fairly written by people within the same, that could be a whole different story, but these, most of the people may have even all known each other, but they're not that, they're probably a very similar education, similar background, where the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible or the Tanakh, it's a very different story. It's many different genres, authors writing over hundreds of years in different geographies. The Old Testament was written in Hebrew and in some cases, the related Semitic tongue of Aramaic, and even some sections of it in Greek. And then not only those languages, but also written in different historical phases of those languages, particularly Hebrew. And Hebrew changed as a language, as all languages are wont to do. Parts of the Old Testament that are older are written in a different form of Hebrew than parts written later. Think of Beowulf's English versus Stephen King and everything in between, where you have different writers or scribes writing in different styles. And I had never really thought about that much until our mutual friend Gil Kedron of the podcast of Biblical Proportions really discussed these different aspects of the actual writing of the Old Testament.
Yeah. See, now you bring up those points. The New Testament is remarkably homogeneous compared to the Old Testament, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and you think about it, say, if you take the tightest difference, Paul wrote, what, maybe 30s, 40s into the 50s AD?
Yeah.
And if you take the Gospel of John as the latest, at the latest, what do some scholars say, 180 AD, which I think is really... really pushing it.
I think the tendency nowadays is to date John to about the same time as Matthew and Luke, round about 100-ish. I think that's the modern trend in scholarship. I used to think John was written way later, but my reading over the years seems to indicate that. And even Revelation is dated to about 100. And the latest book is 2 Peter, I think, which is about 150.
Yeah, so like you said, it's a 100-year span, and the core of the document's really within maybe 50 years. And the source of all these texts, though, particularly with the Old Testament of what we're going to focus on today, is the Septuagint. But what was the Septuagint a translation of, and what should we be calling this fountainhead text? Was there an original fountainhead text, or was there a textual tradition? There almost certainly wasn't one singular canonical text of what the Christians call the Old Testament. Scholars call the older pre-Septuagint text the Hebrew text, the Ur text, the Hebrew textual tradition. But I mean, what should we call it? The Tanakh, the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, all of these, they have... issues that don't really fully explain what we're going for. So the Hebrew text, the Ur text, who knows? Keep all of these questions and concerns in the back of your mind, because we'll really start to delve into each one of them as we move along.
Okay. Now, the Septuagint is a Greek language translation, and translation is never simple. So can you take us through some translation issues here?
So as you said, translation's no easy matter, even in our modern age. Something like Google Translate and other machine translations are pretty good, and they've done a quantum leap since they first started not too long ago, within the last decade or so, and they get better all the time. But machine translations have their limitations. A, not every language is available, even though that's another one where it's the languages that they translate are, it's mind-boggling that they can have machine translations of them. But they often miss subtle meanings as well. Translation is not as much a science as an art. It is objective, but it's also subjective. And the two main ways of translation are literal and then dynamic translations. And they exist on a spectrum from literal to dynamic. And really, no translation is pure literal and no translation is pure dynamic. Literal translations are really, if you go to the most extreme side of the spectrum, is a word-for-word translation, similar in a way to machine translation. It works pretty well for simple sentences, but you pretty quickly lose the meaning of the original text and the sense of flow. And meaning and flow are really as important as anything for language. And then if you turn the dial all the way to the other end, you have the dynamic translation, and that's more of what's the meaning of the sentence or the passage or a paragraph or an entire section. And it's trying to maintain the greater meaning of the text and then maintain the style of the author, the metaphor, the rhyming scheme, alliteration, poetic elements.
I've got an example. I know you've got an example, so I've got a totally different one. Okay, Steve. Now, I think one big scale example is translation, English language translations of the Bible. The best-selling English translation of the Bible today is the New International Version. That takes a fairly dynamic route, a fair amount of paraphrasing. I use instead a translation called the New Revised Standard Version, which is also the one which tends to be used by scholars when they want to put a passage in English. The New Revised Standard Version, its motto was as literal as possible, as free as necessary. So New Revised Standard Version versus New International Version is a perfect example of a literal-ish translation versus a dynamic-ish translation.
Yeah, and it's really, they have to keep turning that knob back and forth.
Yeah.
So that if it's too much to literal, you're losing the real meaning of the text. You turn it too much to dynamic and you hit the problem of, is the translator changing the meaning of the text, or is the translator putting too much of their interpretation into a text? I've heard that examples of that with Dostoevsky. I just listened to something about a person who had read, I think it was Crime and Punishment in English translation, and he had, I don't know, he must have been trying to torture himself. He read it in like three different English translations and found like the latest one. There's one that I suppose is superb, but then he read it in the original Russian and got all sorts of different meanings out of it. So you see that there's almost a problem that you can't fix in reading something in translation. And then I thought of an example, or I didn't actually think of this. This one of an example came from the Timothy Law book of how do you translate even certain words? Like if you're going in a literal translation, like the word enchilada, say a Spanish text is being translated into English, should enchilada literally be translated as a rolled bread filled with meat and cheese? Or do you leave it as enchilada because it's a well-known word in English? Does that idea of enchilada already exist in English? So do you translate it? Or is it saying, well, maybe certain people or demographics would know what enchilada is intuitively, but then maybe people in the other part sections of English speaking world wouldn't be able to know that word intuitively. So how do you translate even just one simple word like that?
That's actually the food example is very good. Sometimes when I'm looking for recipes, the title of the recipe will be something like Lebanese lamb mince rissoles. And in my head, I think you mean kofta, because that's what I know them as kofta. And I'm thinking, you idiots, So to me, kofta is a perfectly usual word. I don't know how many people would understand it, but I eat a lot of Middle Eastern food, and it seems to be dumbing it down if you just say, if you just spell it out in English. But on the other hand, as you say, if you've never heard of a kofta, well, it's just this rando word,
and it's almost like you need a gloss to say, or a footnote or something, a kofta or an enchilada is X, Y, and Z, and that to try and get it locked into your own language schema, that's what that is, so that you can go back and reread the text. And we're just talking about food items here. We're not talking about deep theological or scientific terminology.
I have a little Penguin recipe book, which must date from the 1970s. It's on Indian cooking. It's by an Indian. But in order to describe the techniques, etc., he uses highly obscure French cooking terms. Right? So he's talking about, and so we make the doom with a, which is an Indian term, and we give blah, 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 blah in highly elaborate French. And I'm thinking, you are making this so confusing, so confusing.
That really ties into the Septuagint, because you're taking in the 1970s, the French cooking method would have been the lingua franca or the standard of what somebody would expect to know. Oh, you're going to fricassee it. And what the heck is fricasseeing? Yeah. Especially in the context of Indian cooking. And it might not even exactly model what you're trying to do with the Indian cooking, but they're trying to use it, a term that people might be able to hook into.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point.
So now you see, I mean, just some of the issues that we're going to touch upon with translating such a complicated set of texts and really a rich and deep and just dense set of texts into a whole nother language. I mean, we're just scratching the surface, but I think people can kind of see where we're going with this.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Podcast Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and Richard Lim's This American President, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.